Welcome, everybody, as we continue our series, How Tanakh Evolved. It's a pleasure to welcome everybody. And I guess we left off with the Bechor Shor last week. We'll see where we pick up this week. And Bakasha, Dr. Sokolow.
Okay, let me just get everybody in here.
I guess I was right. You're going back to the Bechor Shor. Okay.
Yeah. No, it's just to complete the picture of Parshanot in northern France before we move across the Pyrenees Mountains into Spain. So I had occasion last week to refer to this, and because it became the subject of a discussion, an after-hours discussion, I thought I would just simply share it briefly. This is a page from what, by all reasonable accounts, is one of, if not the earliest, complete manuscript of Rashi's commentary on Tanakh. It would appear to have been written somewhere, perhaps even in the 13th century. That would make it only about 100 years and change after Rashi's own death. So it certainly is one of the oldest, if not, in fact, as I said, the oldest manuscript that contains all of Rashi's commentary on the Torah, as well as, I'm sorry, on Tanakh. And it happens to be in the library of Oxford University, in the Bodleian Library. And it happens that I was working on preparing a critical edition of a text of Rashi, and I had been working entirely from microfilms. Then I had an occasion to actually be in Oxford. So I thought that I would take the opportunity to actually see and touch the manuscript. So I was able to do that. And in the process of turning the pages, I actually noticed something that had escaped my attention when, instead of turning pages, I was turning the reel on a microfilm machine. And what I noticed was that Rashi's commentary on the Torah ended on what would be whatever the page it was Amud Aleph. So let's call it page X, Amud Aleph. But his commentary on Yehoshua did not begin on Amud Bet of the same page. It began on Amud Bet a page later. So it occurred to me that what had probably happened was that two pages of the folio stuck together, and the original scribe didn't realize it. So when he turned what he thought was one page and went from Rashi's commentary on the Torah to his commentary on Yehoshua, he didn't realize that two pages had stuck together. Subsequently, another scribe came along and found in this manuscript two blank pages. Well, you know that there's a law of physics that says nature abhors a vacuum. Well, so do scribes. So the fact, rather than leave these two pages blank, this later scribe copied out onto one of these two pages the text that you see in front of you. And if you notice what's highlighted in yellow towards the bottom of the page, it says, Miyasod Rabbeinu Shmuel. Yasod is a word that was used in Ashkenaz in the High Middle Ages to indicate somebody's literary output. The corresponding word in English would be opus. So whoever copied these fragments was signifying that he was copying them from something that he knew, or at least assumed to be, written by Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, Rashi's grandson. So I did a quick check of the journals, and I saw that nobody had published this previously. So I went to an Israeli journal, published actually by Bar Ilan University, called Alei Sefer. And I wrote it up, and they were pleased to publish it, and I was delighted to have it published. So this is the text that I made reference to last week. That brings us now to Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, And Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, as I did mention, introducing him briefly last week, was a student of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam's given name was Rabbi Yaakov ben Meir. He was a brother to Rashbam. So that makes Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor now the next generation of Northern French Parshanim. And this chart will indicate something very significant about Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor. The chart, as you see, lists the number of dual interpretations that are provided in the Torah commentaries of Rashi, Rashbam, and Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor. A dual interpretation is where a commentator gives two explanations of the same verse, one of which he designates as the Peshat, the reasonably straightforward, nearly literal meaning of the verse, and the other he'll designate as a Drash, which means something that is either more homiletical or more hermeneutic, something that comes primarily to teach a moral or religious lesson, or to make a point of law, of halacha. And if you notice, looking first in the column of the total number of dual interpretations, notice the disparity between Rashi and Rashbam. That is consistent with what we came to observe about Rashbam last week, and that was that Rashbam was, I won't use the word disdainful of Drash, but Rashbam felt that even the legal portions of the Torah could be explained according to the Peshat, and that there was never really a need to rely on a drasha. Therefore, the total number of such dual interpretations in Rashbam's commentary on the Torah is 35, and it's divided into 14 in narrative texts and 21 in legal texts. Compare that to Rashi, who had a total of 150, right? Almost four times as many, more than four times as many as Rashbam. And as you can see, in Rashi's case, they're primarily in narrative texts and only to a much lesser degree in legal texts. Now see how it's topsy-turvy in Yosef Bechor Shor. First of all, it's remarkable that he has an even greater number of dual interpretations than Rashi. He has 185 in total. And notice the disparity. Only 62, half, a third of them, are in narrative texts, while fully two-thirds of them are in legislative texts. Now, that may very well be because as a student of Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor may have seen himself primarily as a Talmudist, as a legalist, right? And therefore, you can see the preponderance of dual interpretations in legal texts. So the question then is, since he provides so many more midrashic interpretations than even Rashi, it's interesting to try to extract from his commentaries some guidelines. What may have actually guided him in determining whether something required a pshat interpretation or a midrashic interpretation? So here, as you can see, it's an example of where a novel reading of a text supports a midrashic interpretation. The text here is part of Yaakov's blessing to his son Yehuda. And one of the things that he says is Gur Aryeh Yehuda. Yehuda can be compared to a lion cub. Miteref b'ni alita. Teref is a prey or carcass, right? It's actually the Hebrew root of the, shall I call it, English word treif. Okay. It means an animal that has died not as the result of being slaughtered, but as the result of perhaps being mauled or ravaged by another, by a wild animal. So, miteref b'ni, my son, alita, you have risen. So, the general interpretation of the verse is that it's a reference to the son is Yosef. And what Yaakov is saying to Yehuda is that Yehuda somehow redeemed himself. That although it seems to have eventually come to Yaakov's attention that Yehuda was the one who first suggested the sale of Yosef, right? That Yehuda eventually, when he volunteered to stand, as it were, surety for Binyamin, redeemed himself. So that's the standard, the conventional interpretation. Here you can see that Bechor Shor offers a midrashic interpretation in the second paragraph. V'chein matzino b'David. He says that this verse can actually be applied to King David. How? Shehaya sholel v'toreif et ha'umot. Because King David would loot and plunder his enemies. Why? Kidei l'chalek le'echav ha'aniyim. What would King David do with the spoils of war? He would distribute them to the poor. Ulefi agada, therefore says Bechor Shor, there is a justifiable agada, which is that when Yaakov said to Yehuda, Miteref bin Yalita, what he had in mind prophetically was King David, who was a descendant of Yehuda, Miteref sha'ata oseh, from the prey, the plunder that you create, right? Nit aleta, you have been elevated, sha'ata oseh mimenu tzedaka, because you transformed it, rather than keeping it for yourself and putting it into your treasury, you distributed it to the poor, you transformed it into charity. So that is an agadic interpretation of miteref b'ni aleta. Here's another example of a drash that Bechor Shor provides for perhaps a different reason. Here he's going back to one of the very earliest stories in the Torah of how God accepted the offering of Hevel and refused the offering of Kayin. All the Torah says is, Ve'el Kayin vel minchato lo sha'a, that God did not incline, as it were, towards Kayin and towards his offering. It gives no reason for it. Okay? So Bechor Shor explains, Ma'as b'Kayin. That's not just that God preferred Hevel over Kayin, but that God was actually displeased with Kayin's offering. Ma'as b'minchato. Va'asa lahem ot sheyedu, and that somehow God communicated this to Kayin by giving him a sign that he would recognize. Now remember, the Torah is silent on the subject. So what is the sign? He explains, Kichem pershulanu rabotenu, here's his reference to the Midrash, ki ve'esh ana lehevel, that when it says previously that God responded favorably to the offering of Hevel, how did he indicate his pleasure with Hevel's offering? He sent a fire down from heaven, as it were, to consume it. She'arad esh min hashamayim vayochal et ha'olav et ha'mincha. Okay. So how was Kayin to know that his offering was rejected? Because God did not similarly send down a flame to consume his offering. Now, why is this an acceptable interpretation? Because we have reason, we have precedent to understand that acceptable offerings are greeted with heavenly flames. Where? He tells us, by Mishkan. It happened first when in the Chanukah HaMizbeach, right? Remember that was what got Aharon's two sons, right? Nadav and Avihu into trouble, okay? Uba Mikdash. The same thing happened at the inauguration of the Temple of Solomon. And finally, in the case of Eliyahu, when he had his contest against the priests of Baal. Okay, not going to press this any further. It's really come to this as a final illustration of something that is typical of Bechor Shor and yet idiosyncratic. What you have here side to side are two descriptions of an incident in which the Israelites in the wilderness ran out of water. And they turned to Moses and they said, "For this we had to leave Egypt." Right? So what did Moses do? He took his stick, right? And he hit a rock and was able to give the people water from the rock. Now notice the very top. One of these two reports came in the 17th chapter of the book of Shemot. It happens to be sandwiched, as it were, between the crossing of the sea on one hand and the battle against Amalek on the other hand. The second report comes from the 20th chapter of the book of Bimidbar in the Sidra of Chukat. Now the question is, if you take a very careful look at the texts, they are similar to the point of being, in several cases, nearly identical. And yet, the conventional understanding is that these are reports of two different events. That it happened not once, but twice during the 40 years that the Israelites spent in the wilderness, that in order to provide them with water, Moses had to hit a rock. One of them happened at the very beginning of the 40 years, and the other happened almost towards the end of the same 40-year period. Comes along Bechor Shor and takes a very unique position. He says, and you can see the highlighted passages, "It appears to me," he says, "that this," and this is his commentary on the 20th chapter of Bimidbar, "that this is the same incident as the one recorded in Shemot in Parshat Bishalach." Why then does the Torah tell the same story twice? He says that each recitation of the story met a particular narrative purpose. But clearly, he says, it was all one incident, not two separate ones. And he even goes so far at the end to say that this is the manner of many episodes, that this isn't the only time that the Torah actually narrates the same historical event on two separate occasions, but it is the manner of many episodes to be relatively sealed, that is to say, to be provided in relatively minor detail in one case and explained in somewhat greater detail in another. Now, the Talmud actually has a phrase for this. It's called Divrei Torah Aniyim B'Makom Echad V'Ashirim B'Makom Acher. It's usually used to explain legal passages. The Bechor Shor is rather, as I said, unique in respect of using it to explain a narrative passage, but it gives you a sense, again, that Bechor Shor was a highly original thinker and a very original commentator. And with that, we get to leave northern France and, as I said, move across the Pyrenees Mountains into Spain. And we make our acquaintance with someone who was, even if you don't consider him to have been one of the greatest Bible commentators of all times, he's certainly a candidate also for being one of the greatest Hebrew poets of all times, and certainly for being one of the sharpest wits that the Hebrew language has ever known. Here, for example, on the opening slide, is a phrase that Ibn Ezra wrote about himself that helped to answer the question of how long did Ibn Ezra live. If you look in some encyclopedias or in some reference works, you'll find that there is some question about whether he died in 1164 or in 1167. How can I be sure that he died in 1167 and not in 1164? Because I know that he lived for 75 years. How do I know that he lived for 75 years? Because apparently, when he already sensed his death approaching, he wrote about himself the words that you see here. It is a witty paraphrase of a Torah verse. The Torah, at the beginning of chapter 12 of Bereshit, in reporting on Avraham's journey to the land of Canaan, says, V'Avraham ben chamesh shanim v'shiv'im shana b'tzeito mecharan. That Abraham was 75 years old when he left the city of Haran in Aram in order to move to the land of Canaan. And Ibn Ezra paraphrased this and changed it into the Avraham ben Chamesh Shanim Yeshivim Shana. The Avraham here referring to himself, Abraham Ibn Ezra, was, he tells us, 75 years old, Bitzeto, when he departed, Mecharon Af Shel Olam, when he exited or departed from the tumult of this world. And that's basically a hint to the fact that Ibn Ezra considered himself to be rather misfortunate. Just how misfortunate Ibn Ezra thought he was can be seen in this passage that he wrote. It's a poem. It's entitled Galgal Umazalot. Galgal, Galgalim are the constellations, Mazalot are also arrangements of stars. And Ibn Ezra wrote about himself, Galgalu Mazalot b'ma'amadam, right? The constellations, where you see the English translation, the heavenly spheres and fortune stars, Natu b'mahalacham l'moladati, veered off course the day that I was born. Lu yihiyu neirot schorati. If I, says Ibn Ezra, were a candlestick maker, lo yechshach shemesh ade moti, then to spite me, the sun would never set. Igala hatzliach v'lo uchal, I exert myself, I struggle to succeed, but I am unsuccessful. Why? Ki ivituni kochavei shamai, because the heavens, the stars themselves, are working against me. If I were selling a dealer in shrouds, says Ibn Ezra, lo yigvoun ishim b'chol yamai, then to spite me, people would stop dying. So as I said, this gives us an indication of what Ibn Ezra thought was his misfortunate lot in life. Ibn Ezra, by the way, was quite a traveler. Ibn Ezra traveled not only through Spain, but he actually crossed the English Channel. He spent some time in France, northern France, and even crossed the English Channel and spent some time in London. But most of his time was spent in Muslim Spain, and therefore Ibn Ezra was part of that Jewish culture and society, for whom Arabic was a language of literary and mostly poetic expression. And here, at the tail end of his commentary on Shir HaShirim, he provides an explanation, a rationale, for his prolific use of Arabic comparisons with Hebrew in order to explain difficult words in Shir HaShirim. And his explanation is that since Arabic is very close to Hebrew, which he calls Lashon HaKodesh, the conjugations are similar. The use of the letters, the servile letters, Yod, He, Vav, and Aleph, that are used in conjugating verbs, are the same in both languages. The verbal forms for passive, Nif'al, and reflexive, Hitpa'el, noun constructs, Michut, are identical. the numerals, right? Anybody who knows that counting from one, counting up from one in Arabic is wahad, tnin, tlata, arba, can hear the similarity to echad, shtayim, shalosh, arba. Okay? So therefore, says Ibn Ezra, anytime we encounter an unusual word in the Bible, and the word has a cognate in Arabic, that is to say that there is a nearly identical word in Arabic, and that the Arabic word is more frequently used than the Hebrew word in Tanakh, then, says Ibn Ezra, we will suggest that they share a definition, although, and he was very cautious and very scholarly, although he says it remains questionable. He understood Arabic and Hebrew well enough to know that the fact that they have so many similarities doesn't necessarily mean that you can substitute a word in one of the languages for a similar word in the other. I just want to point out something that I actually only discovered yesterday, and that is that the end of a commentary on Shir HaShirim seems to have been a place in which Ibn Ezra was not the only commentator to offer an explanation or an apology for his use of Arabic. I found this passage in the commentary on Shir HaShirim of Rabbi Yosef Ibn Aknin. For those of you who are concerned about these things or who want to know, in case it one day turns out to be the answer on Final Jeopardy, there were actually two people in the 12th century named Yosef ibn Aknin. In fact, both of them were Yosef ben Yehuda ibn Aknin. The difference, and we tell them apart, is that their grandfathers had different names. Both of them have a relationship to Maimonides, to Rambam. This Ibn Aknin, the author of this commentary, was a contemporary of Rambam, and they were acquainted when the Maimon family spent time in Fez in North Africa. The other Ibn Aknin was a student of Maimonides, and if you ever read Maimonides' introduction to the Guide to the Perplexed, you'll find that this Yosef ben Yehuda ibn Aknin was the student, the disciple, on whose behalf Maimonides composed the Guide to the Perplexed. Okay. Hey, Rabbi Kelman, there's an idea. Maybe we'll next year talk about a course in reading introductions.
That is a great idea, by the way. I think my nephew once gave, Tova, didn't Josh once give a series at the Beit when he was a rabbinic intern on introductions to classic works? There's so many. We can start at the Bahag and the 613 mitzvot. That'll take us three quarters of the year, the whole year. We won't do any other books. But I think that's a great idea, but yes, we can talk about that afterwards.
Okay. Anyhow, so this, I said, it's curious. It's an interesting, it's either a coincidence, or it could be that since this Ibn Aknin and Ibn Ezra lived in essentially the same kind of culture, the same civilization, it could be that it's not so much a coincidence as something that was born of their shared cultural experience. But he too gives like a footnote to his commentary on Shir HaShirim, explaining his use of Arabic. And if you just look at the second paragraph, he says that he takes note of the fact that Rav Haya Gaon, who died in 1040, employed Arabic in his writings, even utilizing a stanza of an Arabic love poem to explain a rabbinic term. And he also used the Quran and Hadith, which means traditional Muslim literature. And that he wasn't the first or the only one to do it. He was preceded by Saadia Gaon, who used Arabic, of course, in his Arabic language commentaries, right? And he says that both Rav Haya Gaon and Rav Saadia Gaon did this in deference to the fact that the Talmud says, whosoever says something wise, even a Gentile, is still to be recognized as a scholar. And Ibn Aknin adds, this his wisdom must be transmitted. And here's very interesting that he adds. He adds an historical footnote. He says that Shmuel HaNagid, who was one of the leaders of Spanish Jewry in the 11th century, wrote that Rabbi Matzliach, who became the Dayan, right, the head judge of Sicily, the island of Sicily for a while in the Middle Ages was ruled by Muslims. Okay, that Rav Matzliach came to Baghdad, and one of the things that he brought with him was a biography of Rav Haya Gaon. And one of the things that he read in this biography was that on one occasion, Rav Haya Gaon instructed this Rabbi Matzliach to go to the Christian Catholicos, the head of the Nestorian Church, and to ask how he understood a verse in the Book of Psalms. And Rav Matzliach recoiled. And Rav Haya saw that it was an imposition on Rabbi Matzliach, he rebuked him. And his rebuke was, our pious ancestors who serve as our role models, referring now to the sages of the Mishnah and the Talmud, would inquire about languages and the meanings of words from members of different religions and even from shepherds and cattlemen, as is well known and is attested to widely throughout the Talmud. So Rav Matzliach was persuaded that this was a legitimate enterprise. So he went and he asked the head of the Nestorian Church how he understood this verse in the Book of Psalms. And the Nestorian told him the translation of the verse in Syriac, which means that what Rav Haya understood was that the Nestorian Christians kept what we call, what scholars call the Pshitata, an Aramaic translation of, perhaps translation not directly of the Torah, perhaps an Aramaic translation of the Greek Septuagint. But nevertheless, there was this widespread recognition amongst the Jews of Spain that through their knowledge of Arabic, they would have access to information and to resources that were unavailable to their predecessors. And as we already take a note, they were also unavailable to those of their contemporaries, like Rashi, who simply didn't know Arabic. Now, the fact that Sa'adia Gaon consulted the Quran and consulted Arabic in his voluminous writings should not be taken as a sign that Sa'adia Gaon in any which way was showing them respect. It was utilitarian, as we see in this another passage from Ibn Ezra's Torah commentary, where he disagrees with some of Sa'adia Gaon's identifications of persons, places, or things that are mentioned in the Torah. But he tells us that when Sa'adia Gaon nevertheless provided all of these translations, he did so for the honor of God, and that one of the reasons that he translated the Torah into Arabic was to make sure that people could not say that there are mitzvot in the Torah that we do not understand. What do mitzvot in the Torah have to do with the names of the four rivers of paradise? It's a logical connection. If you come out and say, there were four rivers in paradise, the Torah calls them Pishon, Gihon, Prat, and Chidekel, but I'm not sure what they are. Then, if you come along to the pasuk that says, Ukshartam la'ot al yadecha v'hayu l'totafot ben einecha, and you say, but I do know what the word totafot means. It means tefillin. There's a disconnect. How can you claim to know what one word means and claim that you don't know what the other word means? So when Sa'adia Gaon made it appear as though he understood the meaning and could identify every person, place, or thing in the Torah, he was doing so for a polemical reason. He was doing so in order to be able to defend the rabbinic tradition of Torah interpretation. We looked at this passage in Ibn Ezra when we did the survey of Parshanut. This is Ibn Ezra's classic formulation of a methodological approach to Agadah. Agadah, again, is the narrative portions of the Talmud or of Midrashim, okay, which frequently, as in this case, purport to present us with historical fact. In this case, the question was, where did the Israelites get shittim trees to build the Mishkan? And the Midrashic Agadic answer was that these trees were taken out of Egypt. How did they get to Egypt in the first place? They were planted there by Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu planted the trees, and the Israelites, at Moses' instructions, took them out of Egypt, and those are the trees from which they built the Mishkan. Okay? And as I mentioned at the time, if you look simply at this Agadah and you ask, what purpose does it serve? It serves a very clear, it provides a very clear religious, spiritual message. And that is that it shows continuity. If the very trees that were used to build the Mishkan that accompanied the Jews through the 40 years in the wilderness and remained afterwards for several hundred years until the temple was built, consisted of trees that were planted by Yaakov Avinu, then it's essentially as though Yaakov Avinu himself participated in the building of the Mishkan. Ibn Ezra, however, comes along and says, you know, he says, if this in fact is an historical, if this is, just fact twice, if this indeed is an historical fact, right? Then of course, says Ibn Ezra, that's what it was. However, says Ibn Ezra, I have reason to question its historicity. And what are the grounds on which he questions its historicity? Logical grounds. He reminds us that when the Israelites left Egypt, they left quickly, right? And they left under the pretext of going for a three-day furlough. Therefore, says Ibn Ezra, what would they have done if Egyptians had stopped them and asked, if you're only going for a three-day furlough to celebrate a religious holiday, why are you carrying shittim trees with you? Therefore, Ibn Ezra formulates his methodological approach in what you see here as the second paragraph. He says, behold our quandary. If our ancestors had a tradition, a Kabbalah, meaning that if in fact this information that the trees were planted by Yaakov in Egypt was passed along from one generation to the next without interruption, which is what the word Kabbalah means, okay, then says Ibn Ezra, as much as I have my doubts about it, I'll take it at face value. However, says Ibn Ezra, since we are really unable to determine whether this was an historical fact, it opens the door to the possibility that it was someone's individual opinion, which he calls a sivara. And therefore, says Ibn Ezra, as a sivara, if we have reason to question it, we're entitled to seek an alternative. And his alternative is very simple. He said, who says that adjacent to Har Sinai, there could not have been a grove of shittim trees? Here's a passage we haven't seen before. It's a lengthy passage, so I'm going to try to give you a synopsis of it. You can see the highlighted passage refers to something that's spelled Zion Chaf Vav Resh. Now, if you take that, along with the fact that this is part of Ibn Ezra's commentary to the beginning of chapter 20 in the book of Shemot, and if you remember, because it was only last week, that chapter 20 in the book of Shemot is the Aseret HaDibrot, then you might put two and two together and say, ah, the word spelled Zayin Chaf Vav Resh that Ibn Ezra is referring to here is the word Zachor that appears in the Ten Commandments, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat LeKadisha. Okay, if you figured that out before I finished saying it, Kol HaKavod. Now, what is it about the word Zachor that Ibn Ezra is commenting on? He's commenting on a rabbinic, Talmudic, Midrashic claim that intends to reconcile the linguistic differences between that version of the Aseret HaDibrot that we read last Shabbat and the alternative version that appears in Sefer Devarim. Now, of course, the Aseret HaDibrot were given only once. They were carved twice on two different sets of luchot, right? But they were proclaimed only once. So how do you reconcile the differences in what is arguably only one, a single proclamation? They said, Zachor v'shamor b'dibur echad ne'emru. That the words Zachor et Yom HaShabbat and Shamor et Yom HaShabbat were recited simultaneously. And that's what Ibn Ezra is questioning here. Ibn Ezra says, and he makes reference, in fact, to science, right? He's already conscious of the fact that there is a difference between the way in which we see things and the way in which we hear things. I don't think that Ibn Ezra would have been able to be as correct in terms of the physics as Niels Bohr, and to tell us about the theory of complementarity, that light is simultaneously waves and also rays. But Ibn Ezra knew that when you look at something, you see it instantaneously. But he did know that when you hear something, you have to wait for the sound waves to reach your ear. He knew that simply because he knew that when you hear the peal of thunder, right, and you see the accompanying flash of lightning, you see the lightning first and you hear the thunder later, even though the thunder preceded the lightning. Therefore, says Ibn Ezra, since we know that we have to wait for sound waves to reach our ears, we imagine that we're hearing the word Zachor all together. But the truth of the matter is that we're first hearing Za, and then Ch, and then O, and then R. Za, Ch, O, R. We're hearing it as four separate things, but they come so close to each other that it gives the appearance of being one whole word. That being the case, as Ibn Ezra, even if God is capable of saying two different words at the same time, the human ear is incapable of hearing two different things at the same time. Therefore, Ibn Ezra rejects that rabbinic interpretation that says that you reconcile the two versions of the Ten Commandments by saying that they were proclaimed simultaneously. But now, what do you do about the fact that indeed one text says Zachor and the other text says Shamor? That Ibn Ezra addresses in this passage. Ibn Ezra says, look at the second paragraph, Amar Avraham HaMechaber, that's Ibn Ezra, Mishpat Anshei Lashon HaKodesh, he says, the rule of the speakers of the Hebrew language is Pam Yiva'aru Diburam Ba'er Heitev, on certain, some occasions, they speak in detail, Upa'am, while on other occasions, Yomru HaTzorech B'milot Kitzarot, they will speak briefly, right? sheyuchal hashomea lahavin ta'amam. As long as they are confident that even if they've used fewer words, that the audience will still understand them. And now he formulates it as a rule, and that's what I've highlighted. Vida, hamilot, words, hem kigufot. They're like the body. Hata'amim, the meaning of the word, hem kanishamot. That's the soul. And what is the relationship of the body to the soul? Haguf laneshama, says Ibn Ezra, hu kemo kli. The relationship of the body to the soul, he says, is strictly utilitarian. It's strictly instrumental. Therefore, the neshama, the essence, the soul is the meaning, right? The words are only the physical form that the meaning takes. Therefore, he says, Al-Kain, Mishpat Kol HaChachamim, it is not only typical of Hebrew authors. He says it is typical of authors B'chol Lashon, in any language, Sheyishmeru HaTa'amim. Their principal concern is that the meaning should be conveyed correctly. And therefore they're unconcerned about changes in wording, providing, he says, achar shehem shavot b'ta'amam, providing that the different wording still conveys the same meaning. Therefore, says Ibn Ezra, since zachor and shamor convey the same meaning, just like lo tachmod and lo tit'aveh convey the same meaning, therefore, says Ibn Ezra, essentially, we've resolved the problem. The words in the two versions of the Aseret HaDibrot may be different, but the meanings remain the same. Again, another passage that we haven't seen before. This is from, as long as Ibn Ezra gave his analogy using bodies and souls, it reminded me of this passage, which is from his introduction to his commentary on the Megillah of Echa, in which he says that there are numerous midrashim that have been provided to the book of Echa, and he says that they can be divided into several categories. He says some are esoteric chidot. Others are mysterious, so dote. Others are sublime analogies, nishalim givohim at shechakim. And others are laharviach libot nilot bifrakim amukim, to relieve aching hearts in times of depression. And still others, he says, are le'amei nichshalim, to give instruction to those who are failing, ulemalot harekim, and to fill those who are empty. Therefore, he says, Al-Kain damu legufot ta'amei ha-pisukim. The meaning of a verse, says Ibn Ezra, can be compared to the body. And therefore, to what is the midrash to be compared? Ha-midrashim kemalbushim baguf dvekim. The midrashim should be compared to garments, to clothing. And therefore, what is the relationship of a midrash to the verse? It's again utilitarian. Mehem, some of the midrashim, like some clothing, kemeshi dakim, are as fine as silk, while others, he says, are avim kesakim, as coarse as burlap. V'derech hapshat, right? That is the approach that Ibn Ezra advocates, to deal with the straightforward, almost literal meaning of the text. Hu haguf, that should always be seen as the essence of the verse. Bidvarim nivcharim uvechukim, both in narrative matters and in legal affairs. V'chein amru, and therefore he says that the sages themselves maintain, hamikra kipshuto, right, that scripture cannot be purged of its literal sense. Vadvarim atikim, and says Ibn Ezra, it's old news. I want to finish this section on Ibn Ezra. Next week, we'll look all together in one session at the several successive generations of Parshanim in Provence. We'll look at that next week. So I wanted to conclude with a couple of quintessential Ibn Ezra-isms. Take a good look at what's on the screen. I don't know if you can spot what these are. It's a question and the answer. Okay, I'll read it to you, and it may sound to you as though it's awkward and stilted. It is awkward and stilted. It was deliberately awkward and stilted because it's contrived. The question is, Avi, our father, referring to God in this case, right? El Chai Shimcha, our father whose name is the living God, right? So a person is asking God a question. What is the question God is asking God? Lama Melech Mashiach Lo Yavo. Why is the king Messiah not coming? And what is the answer? The answer is Du'ume Avichem. Here is the message from your father. The message is, Lo ki lo vosh evosh. I will not tarry forever. Shov ashuv aleichem. I will surely return unto you. Ki va moed, at the appointed or appropriate time. So it makes sense, right? The question is, where is the Mashiach? The answer is, don't worry, he's coming, right? Ani ma'amin be'emunah shlema b'viat ha-Mashiach. I believe in perfect faith. Va'af al-pi sheyitmameh, and even if he tarries, achakelo b'chol yom sheyavo. That's pretty much what it says. Why did it have to be contrived, the Hebrew? Don't know if you were able to spot it, but each of these sentences is a palindrome. That means that it reads identically if you start at the end. Take the upper sentence, right? Aleph Beis Yod, that's Avi, right? Aleph Lamed, El. Chet Yod, Chai. Shin Mem Chaf, Shimcha. Lamed Mem He, Lama. So you see that the sentence reads identically backwards and forwards, as does the answer. De'u, right? The Dalet Ayin Vav of Moed. So this is one of Ibn Ezra's geniuses, right? His grasp of Hebrew was such that he was able to compose these palindromes, which pale in comparison to this one. This one, I must tell you, there is some question as to whether it really is Ibn Ezra, and if it is Ibn Ezra, there is still a question about just what inspired it. But it has something to do with honey, right? And something to do with arguably an insect that fell into the honey. And the question was, what is the status of the honey if an insect fell into it? If you remove the insect, right, and you're not certain, you know, what is the status of the honey after you've removed the insect from it? It's not, as I said, 100% clear just what was the actual circumstance that gave birth to this. But what you have here is not just a palindrome. Notice, if I start in the upper right-hand box with the pay, and I read it horizontally, okay? Peirashnu, right? We interpret or we explain. Ra'avtan in the second line. Ra'ev, hungry, ra'avtan, a hungry thing. Third line, shebadvash, that was at one point in the honey. Nitba'er in the fourth line, it was removed. Vinisraf, and it was burned. Now, in and of itself, it's just a poetic way of answering what could be a quasi-halachic question. But take a look now and read it vertically instead of horizontally. And it reads the same way. Parashnu ra'avtan shabadevash nitba'er v'nisraf. And because it's also a palindrome, if we started in the bottom left-hand box with again the letter P, and we read it now from left to right, or from bottom to top, we'd have the same sentence. Parashnu ra'avtan shabadevash nitba'er v'nisraf. On the very bottom, I was looking up Hebrew palindromes on Google, so it gave me a modern Hebrew palindrome. Okay, it says that it was created by the poet Eren Hadas, and if you don't know what a pushtak is, it's kind of like a gang member. If the gang is not the Bloods, but it's, you know, the Sharks or something out of West Side Story, meaning something a little less ominous and a little less threatening. If you wish, a street urchin. Okay, rak pushtak aluv, only a miserable pushtak, bolea ketchup kar, will swallow cold ketchup. Now, of course, you know, it's contrived, and again, but the purpose of the contravent is to create, as you see, if you start at the end and read it backwards, to create the palindrome. And there we are for this evening, and I will take a quick look now at the sources. Yeah, Rav Haya Gaon is Rav Haya Gaon, except that it's a Persian name and it should be pronounced Haya. It's kind of like if you asked, you know, who was the friendliest Gaon? So you can say it was obviously Rav Haya Gaon. But it, as far as I understand, Haya is the correct pronunciation of his name. Now you let me off easy this evening. Okay, so as I said, next week, Emir Tzashem, we'll take a look at several successive generations of Parshanim in Provence. Provence, you may know, if you're certainly into wines, you know, that Provence, relative to France and to Spain, is Nishtahin or Nishtaher, right? Mm-hmm. It straddles the Pyrenees Mountains, and it's not entirely in Catholic France, nor entirely in Muslim Spain. And therefore, we'll see that the exegetes who lived in Provence show some of the characteristics that we've learned to associate with Ibn Ezra on the one hand, and some of the characteristics that we've learned to associate with Rashi on the other hand.
Okay, when are we going to discuss the critical comments of Ibn Ezra about who wrote the Torah?
Well, we did some of that when we spoke about authorship.
Yeah, great. That's when we discussed the Sod HaShivim and all that stuff.
Yeah, we spoke about that. I thought that would be just redundant.
No, that's fine. Okay, just, you know, okay. All right. Thank you very much. Okay, tomorrow morning, where we are starting, Malka Simcha, which is starting from this new series on the Jews of Ancient Egypt at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. So it's a little bit, it's in order not to conflict with Shuli Mishnah class. It's also the time she wanted. She lives in Chicago, so it's actually going to be 9:30, I guess, near Evanston, Illinois. No, not too far. That's at 10:30. Shuli Mishkins is at noon. And then at 8:30, Rabbi Nadi Helfgott will be giving this week's Parshat HaShavuot shiur from Teaneck. And then my shiur 9 a.m. Friday morning on the Siddur. Rabbi Liebtag on Sunday, and I mentioned Mark Shapiro is back Monday night, restarting a series on the rise of Reform Judaism, or traditional responses to the rise of Reform Judaism. That'll be 8:30, beginning on Monday evening, this Monday night. Okay, so hope everybody's well. Hope to see you soon. Please invite a friend, and we look forward to learning with you. And I see, I think there is a question, right? Rabbi Wilinski, I think, has his hand up.
Yeah, thank you. Moshe, first of all, thank you. That was wonderful. When you did the palindrome about the Mashiach, I was wondering if he had a message in doing that. Although given the others, maybe it's just the clever use of the language. So that's what I was wondering. Is he in doing that? Is he trying to say something, or it's just part of the playful thing that he's doing?
If it were Rambam, who has a well-defined philosophy of Mashiach, then it would be clearly intentional and deliberate. With Ibn Ezra, it's more likely to be the playful one. We know that Rambam had to contend with bouts of false messianism. It's not impossible that Ibn Ezra, in his travels, encountered such a thing, but it's purely speculative.
It was a standard way of conveying secret messages, to take a number like five, write your message across in a 5x5 or 5x whatever array, and then read it and then send it up and down. So this was well known at that time, the one which goes across and down, as a standard way of sending secret messages. It was also used by prisoners of the Tsar in Russia.
What would be the secret message if it reads the same forwards, backwards, and upside down?
No, but it wasn't forwards, upside down. You wrote something forwards.
Oh, it wasn't a palindrome. It was you wrote something for that had a meaning backwards that only somebody would know. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Sorry about that. Okay, any other questions?
I did a course in the history of cryptography a few years ago. It's all fascinating.
That is fascinating. It is very cool. Okay. All right, if there are no other questions, we'll let everybody go and have a
good night.
Great to see you soon.
Kodesh Tov.
Kodesh Tov, I guess so. Okay, obviously, until Kodesh Tov. Does Adar Aleph count? I guess so. Only Mikram Migileta, Matanot Levonim don't count. You know, that's when you get, you know, Tov Lev Mishta Tamid.
That's next week, though, right?
Yeah, Rosh Chodesh is probably, when is it? Sunday or Monday? No, Tuesday.
Monday or Tuesday.
Yeah, okay. That's, but, you know, got to wait another month for Purim.
Tuesday and Wednesday.
Yeah, the 29th will be Monday. So, right.
Yeah,
so
Tuesday and Wednesday.
Yeah. Tu B'Shev was on Monday. So, yes, okay. Purim's on a Thursday, so your Pesach's on Shabbos, you know. Rosh Hashanah's on Monday, you know. Atbash, there we go. Okay, Laila Tov, everybody.